is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is Lana joining you with Syrian Girl. Real quick, though, did you all hear the news about the female No Borders activist who was gang raped by a pack of Sudanese men in a migrant camp? Yes, the camp was located on the France-Italy border, and it gets worse. She remained silent about her gang rape for over a month because other left-wing activists asked her to keep it quiet as it would set back their struggle for a borderless world. These are the kinds of insane leftists we're dealing with. There's no living with these people. In the nation we're working to build right now, there's no room for leftists. Everything they touch, they destroy, and they do it in the name of humanitarianism. But of course, brutality against white people is okay. It doesn't count, because we all know if it was a pack of Frenchmen raping one Sudanese woman, all of France would pay forever. Whether they're conscious of it or not, leftists such as these have a death wish because they're already dead inside. So I'm glad leftists aren't having children because that means they'll die out faster. Moving on, today we're going to talk about Syria before the Zionist West began creating conflict. We'll talk about why Syria was a target and what their relationship to neighboring Middle Eastern countries was like. And of course, we'll talk about the so-called refugee crisis in Europe and the sub-Saharan Africans using this as an opportunity for neo-colonization. Also, we'll talk about Russia, the Syrian ally that is being demonized and lied about in Zio media. I really like my next guest, Syrian Girl, who's a true sweetheart. Her and I share many similar opinions. If you don't know who she is, Syrian Girl's a Sunni Muslim from Damascus in her late 20s, with a very popular YouTube channel which she calls Anti-Neocon, Anti-New World Order, and Anti-Zionist. She's been questioned on many mainstream shows and is expected on lamestream news. They're completely oblivious. We're going to cover a lot of ground with Syrian Girl coming up. Syrian Girl, finally we get to connect. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Sorry for being late.
That's all right. Well, it's night your time and morning my time, so I have to give a disclaimer to everyone. I'm not a morning person, but I know this is going to be worth it. Are you feeling awake, Syrian Girl?
I'm definitely a nighttime person, so I'm feeling awake.
So I have to ask, how did you end up in Australia?
Oh, well, bit of a funny story. In the 80s, there was a show that was very popular. It was an Australian show called Neighbours, about these neighbours that have a community and they're really friendly to each other. And my mum was a big fan of that show. I guess you could say she was a bit brainwashed by it because she thought that Australia was this most wonderful place where neighbours are friendly. So she put in the immigration papers and decided to come here just because of neighbours.
Was that hard? Do you miss home?
Back when I was a kid? Yeah, it was very hard actually. I really missed home. I missed my family, my cousins, my grandma. I could already speak English, so that wasn't a big problem, but it was still hard to understand and communicate with like the society and the kids here were a little more, maybe the school that I went to as well. I wasn't used to the kids being that rough, I suppose. I was from a very nice school and then I came to a very rough school. Oh, so yeah, it was difficult.
So since you're a Sunni Muslim, perhaps you can tell us what the difference is between Shiite and Sunni.
Well, I kind of, you know, after learning about Catholicism and Protestants, I liken the difference to that a lot. I would say that the Protestants are a bit like the Sunnis, and the Catholics are a bit like the Shiites. So unlike the Sunnis, the Shiites have a hierarchy. So they have a Pope-like figure called Sistani, and then he has people underneath him. And like the, you know, the Catholics pray differently to the Protestants, the Shiites pray differently to the Sunnis. And it all really started about 1,000 years ago when there was a rift between people who thought one of the relatives of Muhammad, Ali, should be the next leader after the Prophet Muhammad dies, and another group of people thought another person should be the next leader. So really, that's where the rift began, and every other difference since that time has been minute. So there's not a very big difference.
Yeah, isn't it funny? It's always like that. People that are the most similar fight the hardest, you know?
That's exactly what I think. Yes. Recently, a friend of mine was telling me how she's, you know, thinks that Catholics are apostates because they use three fingers instead of five fingers to do the cross from one shoulder to the other. So I thought that was, you know, a little bit amusing because it reminded me of the same things that, you know, some Sunnis say about Shiites.
Well, as you know, the media in Hollywood in the West, it's owned by Zionists and Jews, and our governments are also occupied by what we call dual citizens. So we're never told the real story. And I want to get into why Syria was invaded. But first, give us an idea of what life was like in Syria before it was destabilized.
Well, you know, it's a lot clearer that there are many Zionists who control Hollywood, and you know, that's just it's statistically obvious. Mm. But they also have painted a picture of the Middle East because it suits their Zionist agenda. That's very ugly. But for people who don't know Syria before the war, before, you know, what's shown in the media, it's actually a beautiful place. It's one of the funnest and, you know, most easy to love countries I've ever been to, and I've been to many. And I'm not just saying that because I'm from there. People who are foreigners who have visited there come back and say how nice and welcoming the Syrian people are, how they value, you know, family and community above all else. And everything, we had everything there. We even had a snow park. So, you know, we wanted to copy Dubai's ski park, ski land. Well, it was a much smaller room. I don't know. I'm not describing it well enough, I don't think. But we had a snow park. It was fun.
Yeah, so what was the relations like with Christians? Because we get told a lot of things. So how were Christians treated in Syria? Christians and also women. How were women treated?
Well, you know, Christianity has had its birthplace in the region and has existed in Syria for as long as its age. And the churches stood alongside the mosques. The history is still cherished. And also, not just the Christian history in Syria, but also the Jewish history was cherished in Syria until the creation of Israel. And as a result of that sectarianism, a lot of the Jewish community left Syria because of the creation of Israel. It drove people out. And now, with the creation of ISIS, we're seeing a similar thing happen in an attempt to drive out our minorities, like the Christians. Christianity in Syria has existed for, you know, hundreds, if not over 1,000 years, and there has never been any problems in the past.
So what was the relationship like for Syria with the neighboring countries before the Zio West invaded in the Middle East?
So do you mean this most recent one?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult to say. I think the Syrian government was trying to have a policy of just being friendly with everyone, although having its main allies being Iran and Russia, but at the same time trying not to step on too many toes. So before the war began, actually, it seemed like we didn't have many enemies around us. Qatar was fine, Saudi Arabia, you know, Turkey. We had some rifts and differences between them. Of course, they had a policy of supporting Israel, but we tried not to step on their toes too much. But unfortunately, Qatar had this plan to create an oil pipeline going through Syria and into Europe. And this rivaled another pipeline that was in the works between Iran and Syria. And as a result, you know, Syria decided that it would go with the Iranian oil pipeline deal and not the Qatari oil pipeline deal. This was in 2010. And a year later, we see the war and the insurrection being supported.
Isn't Israel doing some drilling in Syria now too? Didn't they just move right on in there?
Yeah, there's been an area of Syria which they occupy called the Golan Heights. They've occupied it, for the last, since the, before the Six-Day War. And they have now, against the United Nations resolutions and completely against international law, begun drilling into Syrian land and stealing Syrian oil just during this crisis, because they're opportunistic about it.
Well, I want to talk about why Syria has been invaded, because I watched your video on the 8 reasons why the New World Order hates Syria, and I thought, oh, that's why. Syria was independent and they were nationalist. So if you could remember, could you tell us what some of those reasons were?
I hope I can remember them all. But some of them are that Syria doesn't have a central bank. Another is that Syria was opposed to genetically modified food. In fact, it was made law that no genetically modified food is allowed in Syria.
Right.
They opposed the Zionist entity. There's probably several others.
Yeah, that no, I wrote it down here, no IMF bank. And then you had the oil and the pipelines.
Debts, yes.
Yeah. And then they were anti-secret societies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That is another thing that was common in Syrian society, just to speak openly about who runs the world and, the Freemasons. That's something that wasn't seen as a conspiracy theory in Syria, more like a conspiracy fact.
It's funny because Hitler banned Freemasonry too,
Uh-oh. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. And then you guys were your anti-Zionism, of course, and then you're the last secular country in the Middle East. So tell us about that.
Well, I think secularism has been attacked in the Middle East. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the number of secular countries in the Middle East has been dwindling. We saw, we can count the number that was left as Libya, Egypt, and Syria, and these three countries were the ones that are being attacked. And the Arab Spring was basically an attempt to overthrow all of the secular governments that are left in the Middle East.
Of course, we get that. So basically, as you're talking here, I'm saying, okay, Syria actually has some commonalities here with National Socialist Germany. Have you thought about that?
It's run under Baathism, and Baathism is a socialist ideology with some pan-Arabist, not nationalist specifically, tendencies. However, there is another party in Syria called the Syrian Socialist Nationalist Party that forms a coalition with the Syrian government, and they can be seen as, they're called the Socialist Nationalist Party. So there are many similarities, in fact.
And then I also heard you say that Syria had their own stores, so you guys didn't have the same boring capitalist chains, correct?
Well, that's one of the things I've noticed traveling through Europe, is that every single country I've went to had the exact same stores, and the exact same stuff.
Yeah.
And I just felt like, what's the point of traveling at all? It's not like I wanted to, experience different culture. I enjoy, diversity and difference in things. So I don't want to go to a place and see it look exactly like Germany, look exactly like France, for example. But Syria, on the other hand, looked different to anywhere else in the world. Japan is another country that's unique and different to everywhere else in the world. And that, I appreciated that. And that was because we didn't have an open economic policy. Unfortunately, in the last few years before the war began, Syria did begin to show that it was opening its economy. So we started to get something like a KFC and some of the clothing chains from, we had some of the clothing chains come in from Europe. So and people there thought, it's new and exciting. Let's go to KFC. Like, this is so exciting. We've never tried this before. But eventually the novelty would wear off, because the Syrian food itself is much more fresh and more tasty than mass-produced stuff that's been imported.
Chicken pumped with antibiotics.
Yeah, exactly. So It was probably something that happened because of outside pressure, not because and because of the pressure that was placed on the Syrian economy due to the drought that happened as a result of Turkey damming the river that flows into Syria. And that's really one of the root causes of the crisis, is the fact that Syria's economy was put under such pressure due to this river being dammed.
Interesting. And I like too what you brought up earlier about globalism. It's true. It destroys diversity. And really, we see that there is a war on, ethnic nationalism. There's a war to actually erode those differences. And I think the Middle East is not excluded from that. I don't know if you've been paying attention, but European culture is definitely under attack. Now it's like, oh, what does it mean to be Swedish or what's German anyway? We're getting brainwashed with that same kind of globalist think. And it's true, you travel around Europe now, it's the same chains, people are thinking the same, they dress the same, so it kills diversity, and I don't know how people don't see that.
Well, I remember that song that says, "If everybody looks the same, we'd be tired of looking at each other." And it was a song against racism. And I think, that is exactly what we should be saying. If everybody looked the same and if every place looked the same, then we would be tired of looking at each other. And, it's, the Middle East is not immune to the globalism that's happening. Syria's, first of all, one of the prime examples of that globalism is the creation of Israel, where the hundreds of thousands of European Jews and now Jews from all over the world migrated to the Middle East and to land which was traditionally the land of the East Mediterraneans, Syrians, Palestinians, and Jordanians, whether they be Muslim, Christian, or Jewish. But because of this Zionist idea, it became, land for everybody. Another example of that is ISIS. They are from all over the world, Pakistan, Britain, the Caucasus, Russians, South Russia. They're just from everywhere, and they claim Syrian land to be their own. Another example is if you go to even to Dubai or Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, like the majority of people who live there are not locals, they are foreign workers. So, and of course, Dubai is one of those, those countries that accepted globalism and they accept the chains, McDonald's, Cinnabon, everything. Syria wasn't one of the countries that accepted it, so of course they were forced into it.
Yeah, I have to clarify too. There's lots of Jews. They may look white, but they don't identify as white. They're always separating themselves from being white. So they're Jewish before European, and that's why we see a lot of Jews in Europe right now. We see them, they're building walls in Israel. They're deporting their foreigners, but then they go to Europe and they say Europe must become multicultural. Have you noticed any of that?
Well, I have noticed that I did watch videos of some Jews or Zionists who are saying, Germany must accept refugees because this is just like the Holocaust and this is just like Auschwitz. And I find that really ironic because, when was the last time that Israel accepted Palestinian refugees? Why don't we talk about those refugees that were created in the 1950s and they were pushed from their own land? No, we're not allowed to talk about that. As for Jews and race and, that subject specifically, I don't relate religion and race specifically. However, it does also depend on what you identify as. All I can say is when it comes to Syrian Jews, Jews who are historically Syrian, the likes of Jerry Seinfeld, for example. I believe that, and there's actually a community of Syrian Jews in New York. Before the war began, the Syrian government was trying to reach out to those people and ask them to return back to Syria to their ancestral home, because they've we've never had any problems with them until the creation of Israel, and they never had any problems with us. We don't really, you know, I don't hate anyone for being Jews, but I do dislike the fact that Syrians are being scattered all over the world, whatever their religion is. And those synagogues and those churches have been in Syria for thousands of years, and they deserve their community to still exist and take care of them.
Yeah, let's talk about this refugee crisis. What went through your mind when you saw thousands of Africans flooding into Europe?
I think that this has been going on for a long time. I think that it's just something that probably wasn't discussed when it came to the Syrian refugee crisis. It was just something that was along with the wave. But I've seen many African, I don't know if they're classified as refugees, but many Africans who are searching for work in Europe. I'm sure there are some of them are refugees because of Sierra Leone and what's happening in the Sudan and what happened in Libya when, you know, they were ethnically cleansed. However, that's something that's, you know, been happening for a while. And my issue with it is twofold. The fact that, you know, Africa, the chaos in Africa is also being caused. And probably the poorest of the poor of Africa are the ones that are migrating. It's not like Africans who can afford, you know, to live an okay life are the ones who want to risk their lives on a leaky boat and 10% of them might die along the way. And if you notice, it's only really young men.
Yes, it's all men.
Who are healthy that can actually survive.
Yep.
And it's really just you have to question what the agenda is of the governments that are allowing this to happen, because it's never humanitarian. Anyone that tells you that governments are being forced to do something humanitarian because of public pressure, don't believe that. It's absolute naivety.
Yeah.
It's definitely more to do with wages and some kind of globalist conspiracy to destroy nationalism.
Oh, it sure is. It's blatant, you know, and our supposed leaders are just traitors. They don't represent the people at all. This is all part of destroying nationalism, and Europe is one of the targets. Did you know Gaddafi actually warned Europe, if I go down, you're going to go down, because he warned of an African influx coming into Europe?
He did warn that, you know, he controls the port, I think it was of was it Tripoli or Benghazi?
Yep.
And when he goes, that port is going to be in total chaos. So yes, he did warn about that. At the same time, the Africans who had worker visas in Libya or had a community in Libya were ethnically cleansed and slaughtered by the Libyan rebels, which Europe supported. So that is obviously something that contributed to that. I have to say, you know, every case individual, there's some people who are completely opportunists. There's some people who are criminals on the run that are traveling from all over these countries to Europe. And there are some people who are just completely and utterly desperate. And in my view, the solution, however, is not to airlift the entirety of the Middle East and Africa to Europe, nor to airlift the entirety of the ISIS-minded people to Syria. You know, there's got to be a better solution, and that's to fix the problems at home and to stop the neocolonialism and the imperialism that's occurring around the world. And I learned something interesting, that France was still charging a lot of African countries a colonial tax, in spite of the fact that they are heavily in debt to the IMF.
Interesting. Yeah, exactly. If we want to help, why don't we help them there? Why do we have to import them in? And then also, secondly, if they are refugees, offer temporary residency. Then when the war is over, send everyone back to their homeland, because that's where they belong. Otherwise, we have all this conflict happening. I mean, there is a Muslim conflict in Europe. I don't know if you're paying attention, but what is your view on some of that?
I think that temporary residence is really the answer. And I say that as an immigrant. So I understand I'm going to come off as a complete hypocrite when I say this. But I was a child when I immigrated here. I didn't get much of a choice in the matter. And if I did have a choice, you know, that would have been the best case scenario. I do believe that somebody immigrates to a country, they should do so because they admire something about that country or its culture and they want to embrace it. Otherwise, temporary residence is probably a better option. In Syria during the Iraq War took on 2 million Iraqi refugees, which we bore, our small economy bore the brunt of that. But in Syria, you cannot have Syrian citizenship unless you're Syrian by blood. We had Somalians that lived in Syria since the 90s and Palestinians that have lived in Syria since the 50s. But even those cases, Syrian citizenship was not given unless by blood and or marriage. But that marriage would be to the children, not even the spouse. So I don't think I would like it, personally, if someone from a completely different culture, let's say something, I don't know, something completely and totally outside of Syrian culture, Native Americans came in and settled in Syria en masse and then decided the way it should be run should be their way of life. That's what happened to us when Israel became into existence. It was a whole lot of illegal immigration, and then they decided that this is our land. I'm not saying that that's not necessarily what's going to happen with immigrants going into Europe. However, if you look at what's happening in Britain, for example, we have a lot of Pakistani immigrants who have suddenly decided that they want things run in a more extremist Islamist way in certain areas. That might be something that is not across the board. It might be something that's actually highlighted by the media because they want to stir these conflicts. But there are cases of it actually happening. I remember I read a tweet today that a feminist in Sweden wanted to ban church crosses as not to offend Muslim immigrants. And I can guarantee you that the Muslim immigrants themselves did not ask her to do that. She would have done that of her own accord.
Liberals in Sweden are insane. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, there's been such things happened in Britain where, you know, liberals have gone and said, "Oh, we should ban this because it's going to offend immigrants," and the Muslims have come out and said, "No, we never said you should ban it. Like, why are you putting this on us?" Because obviously, what's going to happen is they're going to get their hate. They're going to hit get hated on. That's not to say there aren't any crazies in the bunch. I've seen, you know, ISIS protests in Sydney and in Germany.
Yep. England
So
too. Yeah.
yes, so it's complete chaos, really. And I think even those these people who are sympathetic to ISIS, some of them are not even first generation immigrants, they're second generation immigrants, and they're probably the reason that they're doing it is they feel maybe disenfranchised or that they don't belong, and so they're looking for some kind of belonging, and they find it in the worst place possible. Perhaps they come from low socioeconomic backgrounds, and so they haven't had the proper education to realize that they're joining a cult. So I think that a lot of the time, what happens when there's upheaval and there's wars, and people lose everything that they own. Or they have to go to, even if it's just immigration, when you're going to a new country, you pretty much have to start from scratch. You have to find work, you have to find house, and it's difficult. You have to build yourself back up. And if you're starting from nothing, then what's going to happen is you're going to end up in a ghetto. And you have these small ghettos of immigrants forming, not just in Europe, in Australia, the same thing happened with every flow of immigration. And it takes about 20 or 40 years for that group of people to bring themselves up out of poverty. And it just so happens that statistically, poverty creates crime and it creates radicalization. You know, it's funny, in Sydney, some of the same people who are carrying those ISIS flags 5 years ago, they were the same people that were selling drugs. How do I know? I speak to Muslim police officers in Sydney who pick these men up. So, you know, it's a symptom of a disease, I suppose, which it's created by these globalists.
I noticed in Sweden, too, and I would say the majority of immigrants coming into Europe, they're not actually refugees. And then they come and they sit on welfare. They have lots of children. They're outbreeding us because Europeans generally don't have that many children. You know, we plan things out. We like to be prepared, have money. So there's a resentment forming of the native population because we didn't vote for this. And then they're coming in and we get called racists for, you know, pointing out bad behavior. So there is this conflict that's there. I mean, how would you resolve that? Because, I mean, multiculturalism just, it's not working. So isn't separate homelands the answer?
I think the best way to, I don't know how you, this if this is achievable or not, but I would petition the government or somehow force the government not to allow them to have permanent residency, permanent like citizenship. Citizenship should have more stricter rules, in my opinion.
I agree.
Is that not the solution?
Yeah, I agree.
And the other solution is to stop them creating all these wars and supporting terrorism overseas. That would be helpful.
Yeah, and for us, it's like, who do we go to? Our governments are all completely occupied. You know, our politicians, they don't care about us. They don't listen to us. They just do what they want anyway. So it's going to have to take some kind of a mass coup or mass revolt. But I think that it might get there because people are waking up to, you know, Israel's bad behavior and people are getting fed up with what's going on in Europe. So, you know, keep pushing. I think that people will act out.
Oh, well, I think that I identify a problem with people who are nationalists. If you look at who gets most of the numbers when it comes to protests, it's been the, you know, like refugees welcome rallies that are organized by GetUp. And the reason that they have such numbers is they run under a humanitarian line. You know, people are human beings first and foremost. They feel for each other. And when they see a child drown on the beach, their obviously first instinct, usually in most cases, is to not look at it deeper than that and just try to be kind. And that is a good thing. However, it's being exploited by people who are creating these wars and creating the drowned children. And I guess my advice to nationalists would be not to react the way that people like George Soros expect them to react, with hatred or to basically, as that woman did, she kicked a little girl, I think, that was crossing the border. She kicked a little Syrian girl. That's something that is exploited and used to tarnish all nationalists with. The only way to get those numbers and to get those protests is not to react against the fake humanitarian crocodile tears, but to use humanitarianism that's intrinsic to people and show them the right way to fix the problem, not the wrong way. Because that's what I've feel that is frustrating to me, because even I, as you know, people when they feel that they're being humiliated or that their people are being disrespected, their immediate reaction is anger and hatred and being defensive. So when I, for example, see Syrians or even Middle Easterners in general being, you know, even like, for example, Iraqis or Palestinians disrespected, of course you feel, you know, insulted. And that's not something that is helpful or useful for both nationalist parties. The best way forward is to respect each other, in my belief.
Well, that's good advice. And, you know, we have to unite and say, well, we want human rights for all people to have a homeland. And really, at the end of the day, what this is going to come down to is having people of different nationalities and races, I think, having to unite against Zionism, because we all have Zionism in our countries that's been meddling and creating problems. But if it was, you know, just one country in Europe that rose up against it, it would be, you know, World War II all over again. So we need more of a bigger worldwide co-op, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think so. And be careful of the spoilers on this side of the fence, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I wanted to ask, I saw some footage of women in Syria fighting ISIS. Tell us about the Syrian women. What's going on with them?
Syrian women in the Syrian military have been there since, you know, the 60s and the rise of Baathism. So that's nothing really new. They haven't been given many front line roles. They've been given supporting roles for the most part. But some of them are like highly trained commandos and Republican guards that do go to the front lines. Some of them are also medics. There's some of them are snipers. This is, you know, in the Syrian army. And also there's much of the media has been concentrating on women who are in the Kurdish militia, the YPG. Not enough of media attention has been given to women who are part of the Syrian National Defense Force, which is like the Syrian Reserve Army and the Syrian military. Yeah, but, you know, I don't know if your viewers know, but Syria is a secular country. Mm-hmm. Yep. Women can join the armed forces, and they have been since the 60s. So it's not really anything new. And now that we're in a state of war, of course, it's going to be something that happens.
Yeah, I just wonder, because it seemed like, are the men leaving? Because we just see footage of all these men fleeing. So what's going on with the women? Why aren't they with the guys?
Oh, well, the thing is about the men, you mean fleeing the refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing, though. When you see a lot of men in those images, that's because a lot of them are immigrant workers that aren't from Syria. You know, it's not all Syrian men that are fleeing.
Sure, of course.
I see a lot of photos of, and it's mostly young men. And that's because it's not the Syrian families that are fleeing across. The people who are refugees that I've seen, you know, I think a substantial portion of them are families, women, children. And if you look at the refugee camps, here's what I suggest any of your viewers do. Google Syrian refugee camps and look at the type of people that are there. The vast majority of them are women and children. And then Google refugee crisis, and you'll see a very stark difference between what, you know, the 2 million, 3 million Syrian refugees that are in Turkish and Jordanian camps versus the people who are coming in off the trains in Germany. That's really because they're not all Syrian. And that's not to say that in individual cases, there aren't some men in Syria who probably used to be rebels who have given up the fight and decided to make a run for it.
Now, is all of Syria destroyed, or are there parts that are still okay and livable?
It's funny because Damascus, for example, you can probably walk 10 meters to a section that is completely and utterly destroyed. And then, you know, 2 km away, there is life as it always has been, parties and nightclubs and restaurants. And, you know, everything's completely normal, just as it was before. So there's definitely parts which are not completely destroyed. The coast is fine. Damascus is fine. You know, it's like a pocket in the eye of the storm, I suppose. And it's just really sad and unfortunate, because when you look at the parts that have been destroyed, these are entire suburbs. And when I say suburbs, in Syria, suburbs are high-rise buildings. We don't have suburbia like villas like they do in the US or Australia. They're all high-rise buildings. And every one of those homes in those buildings had a family of four. And you just question, where are they all going? And there's 7 million internally displaced refugees. The majority of people who have had their homes destroyed in Syria have chosen to stay in Syria, not go to the refugee camps that are in Jordan and Turkey. They've found some other accommodation that is like makeshift accommodation in Syria, and they've been living under, you know, inside school gyms, you know, and courtyards for the last 3 years. That's the people who are going to Europe are vastly in the minority, in the thousands, not in the millions.
Yeah, it seems like too. I mean, it's typical. It's like America too. It seems like we also get the worst of every people. You know, it's like you have your version of white trash too, I'm sure, in Syria. You know, and so we're getting some of those, I think.
I think you're getting a mixed bag, definitely. You know, some of the people you're getting are actually the poorest of the poor, of course, who have either because they're just poor and they want a better economic situation, or because they were rich, they had a factory maybe in Aleppo, and that home and that factory has been completely destroyed, so they've got nowhere else to go. Or you're getting the other side of it, which is you're getting the rich people who have enough money to buy a plane ticket to fly over, or have a university education and would have been really useful in rebuilding the country. But unfortunately, they have been sort of taken away to Europe rather than, you know, being. I think the Iraqi and the Afghan government are actually complaining about the fact that there's been a brain drain of their nation, and because of all of the people that actually have degrees that have decided to find, you know, a better way of life somewhere else rather than rebuild the country. And that's what happens to these countries. I think that is one of the other insidious reasons behind opening the floodgates, because I'll tell you for sure, even members of my own family have migrated under workers' visas to countries in Europe, and they're not under refugee status. They have a worker visa, but it's like they aren't in Syria anymore. They aren't engineers in Syria. They aren't doctors in Syria. They're trying to find, you know, they're trying to use their skills in a place where they can be safe. And it's not just the case that you're getting the worst, but I'm sure some of them are, you know, some of the rebels that decided to declare defeat and run away, which are the worst of the bunch. So yeah, I would say it's a mixed bag.
I wonder too, are some of them afraid to go rebuild on the parts of Syria that are okay? Do they think that they're going to be attacked and it's all going to be destroyed again? Or I wonder what goes through their head.
I think that it's just that there's no like livelihood. If you take, you know, it's very different. I have a friend who is in the Syrian army. Before the war began, he was just this party animal that went clubbing every night. And I never in my life think that he would become such a stand-up guy. But in his words, he would never leave his country when she needs him the most. And he just turned out to be this, you know, definitely not what I used to think of him. I used to think he was more shallow, but very deep guy. And then on the other hand, you have people who had a life in Syria. They had jobs, they were happy, they had their friends, they had their family, and then suddenly a bomb drops and everything is wiped out and they have nowhere to go. They have, if you can imagine, if your kids don't have a school to go to anymore, or if you're, you know, you're 20-something and you don't have a job anymore, or there's no water anymore where you live, where are you going to go? And if it's not something that is happening just for a month or 2 months, it's been happening for 3 years, you start to think, what am I going to do with my life? Like, where is there going to be a future? Am I ever going to get back? Because I remember when this crisis started, the favorite thing that people would say, and I would say it myself, is it'll be over soon. It's all going to blow over very soon. It's not going to last. I'm sure it's not going to last. 1 year passes. I'm sure it's going to be over. 2 years pass. 3 years pass. Then it starts to sink in that it's not going to be over. And maybe for some people, it's either fight or flight. And some people fight and some people just try to find a way out. And most of them end up in refugee camps. The poorest and most downtrodden end up in refugee camps or on a leaky boat on their way to die, drown, or reach Europe. But the people who still had a house or still could afford a plane ticket, thankfully, you know, members of my own family found work visas somewhere to wait it out, or went to university somewhere to wait it out. So why don't they go back and rebuild? The problem is the war is still going. The terrorists are still coming in. Even in the safe areas, you could still have a bomb dropped on you at any moment. And no money is being sent in to rebuild. That isn't to say that there isn't plans, or there isn't rebuilding happening. There is. In Homs, there's already been a lot of towns that have been homes that have been rebuilt, and people have returned to that city, even though it was completely destroyed. It's amazing to see that within 1 year, an area that was complete rubble has become houses and buildings again. And it's really inspiring, but it's just not enough. There's not enough money. And if there's any money that should go anywhere, it should be towards rebuilding Syria so that people can go back. Not so that the population can be totally displaced from everybody and everything they loved.
Let's talk about Russia. I'm Russian, by the way. I'm hardly American, but Russia is in Syria, and they've been demonized in the media, saying they're killing children, you know. So does Russia have permission to be there? What's your take on Russia bombing ISIS? Because apparently they've obliterated forces in 72 hours.
Oh, I didn't know you were Russian. Hello.
Hi.
No, sorry. My view is that Syria and Russia have been allies for a long time, and Russia is the only force in Syria right now, the only air force in Syria that has legal right to be there because it has permission from the Syrian government. The US and its allies do not have permission, nor from the United Nations, nor from the Syrian government. So they're basically breaking international law. And if we remember, the United Nations was created to prevent a world war. So they are completely acting outside of the law. Russia, on the other hand, has a real and honest objective to fight ISIS. Unlike the US government, who has facilitated the growth of ISIS in Syria to start with. Before 2011, there was no ISIS in Syria. It was only after the support of the Muslim Brotherhood insurgency that started the fertile ground for the growth of something like ISIS. It was only because of the neighboring countries such as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar that so much money and funds went to promoting these radicals. The US, even in their own secret, you know, leaked cables and in the speeches of their think tanks, have an obvious agenda to divide and balkanize Syria and Iraq. And ISIS is a great tool in that, because it's smack dab in the middle of Syria and Iraq in the most oil-rich area, and it divides the two countries. The idea that the U.S. actually wants to destroy the thing that it gave birth to, the U.S. government, that is, not the U.S. people, of course, is, you know, it's naive, because they themselves said that they don't want to destroy ISIS, they want to contain it. They've used the word contain numerous times, and, you know, they've said this is going to take decades and decades just to contain ISIS. They don't want to destroy it. They just want to draw the boundaries of the state that is going to be called the Islamic State. And they actually have this crazy idea. One of the people who runs a think tank, Joshua Landis, said that the US should just accept ISIS as a state. They should just declare it as a state. So when it comes to Russia, Russia actually has an objective to destroy ISIS. They don't want to contain it. They want it gone. And so they're going to actually put up a much stronger fight against ISIS, and not just ISIS, but Al-Qaeda. And it's funny to see in the US media and people like Brzezinski right now complaining that Russia isn't just targeting ISIS, but yeah, Al-Qaeda as well.
Mm-hmm, I know.
So and of course, the thing about civilians, they started talking about civilians being killed by Russia before Russia even dropped its, you know, first bomb. And at the same time, they dropped, you know, a bomb on Afghanistan, killing scores of people in a hospital. So you know, this thing about civilians, I just don't understand how they can have the gall to use that, this humanitarian thing still after everything.
I know. It's pretty amazing. Yeah, you pointed out, I think it was on your Twitter feed, of our media put up some picture of some children that Russians supposedly killed. And you pointed out, no, those kids died 2 years ago. Right?
Yes, exactly. And it wasn't the first case. There's been three cases of that now, of kids who had, they've already reported were dead 5 days ago. Now suddenly they've been killed by Russians. So obviously in a war, there's going to be kids killed because war is hell. But who started this war? And who are the people that can't give up? We cannot, the Syrian government and the Syrian people cannot surrender to Al-Qaeda. That's not even a question. So there's not really anything else I can say about that.
Do you think Russia is going to make a big difference there? Is it going to really impact things for the better?
I really, really hope so. We're all very hopeful. We, of course, the Syrian Air Force had an air force in the skies. They were bombing ISIS and Al-Qaeda targets. But the Russian presence has changed the dynamic, because just before Russia entered, the U.S. had started, the U.S. government officials, like Obama, started to make comments like, we know, if the Syrian military attacks the moderate rebels, we will start attacking the Syrian military, or we're going to create a buffer zone in Syria, which means we're going to allow Turkish troops inside Syrian territory. Now that Russia has entered, Israel has not even been able to attack Syria. Its presence, even if it doesn't have the full effect on ISIS and Al-Qaeda as we'd like, has helped make the U.S. and its allies back off, so that they don't try to break the deal that was made between Kerry and Lavrov about the chemical weapons that was happened in 2013, which was that the U.S. would not attack the Syrian military.
Now, what can you say about who's funding ISIS? I know you get into this quite frequently, but what can you say about that?
Well, Robert Fisk, when he wrote an article pointing out that the most likely person behind the funding of ISIS was Saudi Arabia, actually was threatened with a lawsuit from the Saudi Arabians. And it just goes to show that they're afraid of that kind of thing coming out, because it's very believable, because where there's smoke, there's fire. The ISIS isn't, what it isn't, is just getting its funding from oil revenue or from, you know, collecting money and weapons from just loot that is taken over. No, it's getting support from a state. And the most likely people are Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Turkey allows them corridor into their border. They let them into the country. They stamp their visas, even though in one article I read, the guys blatantly said, I'm coming here so that I can cross the border and jihad in Syria. Still gets his passport stamped and allowed into the country. They're riding Turkish metro stations. I mean, Turkey's playing this dangerous game of letting these international terrorists into the country to cross the border into Syria. It just shows blatantly that, you know, their border guards are filmed talking to them. The money is coming in from the mosques and the sheikhs that are living in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and other Gulf countries.
What are your thoughts on the filthy rich Gulf states? They're not helping their Muslim brothers, and they're not even helping Palestinians. Why is that?
Well, they said it themselves, because in the words of a Kuwaiti minister, that we can't allow Syrian refugees into the country because they're a different culture, race, and you know, way of life than us. They come from a different environment. So it wouldn't be a mismatch to let them into the country. And, you know, that's fair. However, they have millions of Pakistani immigrant workers in the country, and they have millions of European immigrant workers in the country. That didn't stop them from doing that. So it's complete hypocrisy, of course. On the other hand, the money could have be maybe if it's a concern about money, they could take the money they're giving to terrorism and perhaps put it into rebuilding Syria. So with the whole the Brotherhood of Muslims and the Brotherhood of Arabs that, you know, the Pan-Arabists try to espouse, or even the Muslims try to espouse, where was it when it came to the Palestinians over the last 50 years, 60 years? It's not the Syrians themselves that have just come face to face with the hypocrisy, because they have, and it's been a slap in the face for some of the people that believed in that. But the Palestinians have been facing that for so many decades. And I think that Palestinians and Syrians, people from the Fertile Crescent, are different to the Gulf. They're different culturally and they have different way of life. And of course, if you look at the Gulf, they're mostly allies with Israel anyway. They're not allied to the Palestinians. So yeah, I don't think there should be any expectations from them to do anything.
So what do you think the Middle East would be like today had the West never intervened?
Well, it would have been what it was like in the 1940s. Countries that were just picking themselves up after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and the history of those countries were that they created, they were the birthplace of civilization. They, invented phonetic language. This was the ancient Phoenicians of Syria. And probably we would have continued onto that route to become prosperous countries, because there's no reason why we shouldn't be. Syria had fertile land and a lot of, you know, they could be totally self-sufficient. They had oil, they had food, no reason not to be in trade with other nations. Iraq had a lot of oil. And, you know, even the Gulf countries that don't have that history of civilization, that don't have the, but have like a history of trade and have a lot of oil wealth, even they would have been better off without control, because they're really just wasting their money on ridiculous projects that will have no, future to them. I mean, Dubai built a island in the shape of a palm tree. That's not going to be something that's going to make them money in future. That's not sustainable. That's just throwing money at foreign corporations. That's the only thing that these Gulf countries, which we call gas station nations, ever are accomplishing by being completely co-opted by their puppet masters. They're just giving all of the wealth that was God-given to them, that comes from the oil, to foreign corporations, and leaving their future and their children's future completely desolate. If there wasn't any imperialism or Western meddling since, you know, the 1918, then Palestine would still exist. Jews, Christians, and Muslims would still be living in Palestine without any problems. Same for Syria, same for Iraq. They wouldn't be completely destroyed. People would be happy where they are and proud of where they came from.
Last question for you. When I saw some footage of Syria before this mess, it actually reminded me of European culture in a way. And there were people who even looked more European, like the blonde Yazidis in Iraq. You probably know who extremists wanted to genocide. So living in Australia, what similarities are there with Syria?
Well, Australia is a bit far from Europe.
It sure is. It's different.
It is a bit different. But I'm going to go a little bit closer to Syria, back to Europe. And when I went to Greece and Italy and Spain, you know, I saw a lot of similarities between Syria and Greece. First of all, the climate was exactly the same as Syria in Greece. The people looked very similar in Greece and in Syria. The food was pretty much the same. They have what we call mezze in Syria, you know, small, tiny dishes like hummus and those rice vine things, yogurts and cheeses. The Greeks have a very similar thing. The dancing is very similar. You know, we do this thing where you go around in a circle and you stomp your feet, called a debke. Those, you know, that region, the climate, the Mediterranean people are very similar. And we siesta the same as well. And we stay up late at night. That's not the case for Australia at all. I think English, like really Western culture, Northwest with the cold climate, created very different way of life and culture. But
yeah,
I do saw a lot of similarities between Mediterranean people. I mean, I think I wouldn't have much of a culture shock going to Italy or Greece or Spain if I came from Syria. But there are similarities in Syria between, yeah, there's a lot of and historical similarities, because if you look at the ancient times of when the Romans were taking over and, the story of the Trojan Wars,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Trojan, that area, that's all Syria. And that's where our history comes from. The name Europa comes from an ancient myth about a Phoenician princess called Europa. So that's where Europe gets its name from a Phoenician princess whose name is Europa. And of course, Phoenicia is ancient Syria. So there are a lot of similarities there. Syria is like in the east part, most part of the Mediterranean. And if you look at our climate, it's very different to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, because what they eat is rice and meat, because they don't have as much plantations as we do. They have to import their fruit and vegetables from the Fertile Crescent like Syria and Lebanon. And so because of that environment difference, because we get snow in Syria, which we don't get in Australia, by the way, never seen snow here, it's obviously it's the climate that creates a different lifestyle and a different culture. The only people we do have similarities with the rest of the Middle East, of course, but the Middle East is not one homogenous block as it's presented in the media. That's we have a diversity in the Middle East, so that's not something that's really talked about.
Well, Syrian girl, I really appreciate your time today. It's been fantastic. And I love all your informative videos, and I hope you make more of them. But please share your websites and your YouTube channel and let everyone know how they can find you.
Sure. My website is, my Facebook is just Partisan Girl or Mimi Al-Laham. My YouTube is Syrian Girl Partisan. My Twitter is Partisan Girl. And I have a Blogspot. Syrian Girl Blogspot. I'm really sorry for the confusion with the names. I don't know what I was thinking. But yeah, if you find one of those, I'm sure you can find all of them.
Well, thank you so much. I hope you have a good evening, and it's been a blast.
Thank you for having me.
One thing that drives me mad is when I hear that all European white countries must pay for the wars in the Middle East. So it's our duty to take in every person claiming to be a victim of Western imperialism and colonialism. First off, do we blame all Jews for killing Palestinians? Do we blame all Arabs for terrorism? Do we demand reparations from Jews for Jewish Bolshevism in Russia that killed millions? Do we demand reparations from Northern Africans for the Barbary slave trade? But of course, we blame all whites on the planet, no matter what country you live in, for Western imperialism. There are over 400 Indo-European languages and over 55 white countries, yet all white people, no matter what their history, must pay for the wars in the Middle East and colonialism. In colonial times, it was small numbers of Europeans, a few families that traveled to foreign lands, but they did not collect welfare when they arrived, and a few families certainly did not rape the resources of Africa. It was physically impossible back then. No, they had to make deals and make friends with the local population or they'd be slaughtered. So they built roads and infrastructures, traded, taught skills, and worked with the local population. It's not like those families possessed the technology they do today. The locals in these lands didn't even know about the resources they had on their land until Europeans showed them. But we're talking about small numbers of white people, not millions. Colonial families built infrastructures that are still in use today in places like India and Africa. I've seen it myself. And when you speak with the locals in some of these areas, they're glad that the Europeans came. We wouldn't even have a map had it not been for European explorers and colonialists. We wouldn't know about foreign cultures, plants, and animals had it not been for these people. Back to government and blaming all white people. We all know government does what it wants, no matter what race the country is, and the West is no exception. Our government in America has been hijacked by a hostile minority with dual citizenship that has convinced other members of the governing body to fight for its interest. We never got a vote on whether we should invade the Middle East. And it's also true that foreign countries do cry out to America for help. And the Middle East was not perfectly peaceful without its problems before America got involved. Another mind screw is that we're told Arabs created 9/11, but now we're supposed to let in any Arab without question and can't assume they're a terrorist? But all white people are guilty? The best thing that could happen is for whites to pull out of the Middle East altogether and never come back. Let the Middle East be the Middle East. Nationalists don't meddle in other countries' problems. This is because of globalism. If there are true refugees, help them where they are or help them get set up in a nearby culture and landscape that's similar. We're already sending Turkey loads of money for the refugees they've taken in. We, innocent, hardworking European folks, already pay billions for refugees outside of our countries and for them in our countries. If there are Syrian refugees in Europe, they should only be able to stay on a temporary basis like tourists, and then go back home after the war, or be relocated nearby to their home. They should also be dispersed to other Middle Eastern countries, including the Gulf states and Israel. Why not use part of Africa where the land is suitable and where the space is ample to build a space for them there? You can't blame all white people for what APAC's foreign policy creates. We are caught in a war between Semites and their ideologies and religious doctrines. Until we can all say, both Jews and Arabs are not our concern, this will continue. And you know what they both have in common? They both want to kill us. The infidels and the goy. Okay, everyone, my website is radio314.com, where you can find our social networks and other shows. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. I'll be back next week with Andrew Anglin. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.